Between abnormal and paranormal. Enter at your own risk into the paranormal.
You know, there are a few subjects like the subject of UFOs, of ufology, that gets people in the paranormal community. I know a lot of you are interested in other subjects like ghosts and spirits and about Bigfoot and portals and time travel, and we cover all of that stuff here on the program, of course. But this weekend, we are going to be talking about the UFO subject. Tonight, we're going to talk about the story of Kecksburg, which is one of those famous UFO events. Now, I like to look at these events because over time there's been a lot more evidence than was initially available of the events, and now we have a cover-up. There's always been a cover-up, actually, as far as Kecksburg is concerned, which, if you're not familiar, happened on December 9th, 1965. It was then that a UFO crashed near the town of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, and that's how it got its name. A fireball was witnessed by people in six U.S. states and also up in Canada, and everybody seemed to want to weigh in on this and basically say it was anything but a UFO. A statement released by NASA in 2005 says experts examined fragments from the area and determined that they were from a Soviet satellite, but much like much of their work, somehow they just get lost in the shuffle. The records of those events at least get lost in the shuffle, but no doubt, this incident is one of the most notorious in UFO history. So why not have a film about that? Cody Knotts has produced and written five feature films and directed four of them. He's a director, producer, writer, and actor, former editor of The Weekly Recorder, a newspaper covering Pennsylvania and national politics, which helped free two individuals wrongly accused of murder. He was also a two-time candidate for the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, and his latest film is called Kecksburg. Inspired by the December 9th, 1965 events. Cody, welcome into the paranormal. Pleasure to have you here.
How are you? I like being in the paranormal.
I've always been fascinated with it. I've had Stan Gordon on the program before, and he was, you know, well entrenched in the whole Kecksburg UFO incident. When did you first hear about what happened? And what was your initial reaction to that?
Well, actually, I was watching Unsolved Mysteries when I was a child. And hearing it with Robert Stack discussing it. And so I knew it was in Pennsylvania, but I had no idea how close it was to where I was living because it was in another county and I was a kid, so I didn't actually go over there. And so then when we had a film that we did called Gore Orphanage about a haunted location in Ohio. And in the process of making that film, we realized how powerful urban legends are, and we decided that we would start focusing on making films regarding urban legends primarily. So that we went looking for the right one to do next, and that's when we landed on Kecksburg.
So how far were you away from the crash site?
When I started the script, when I saw it the first time, I was probably about an hour and something away. But then when I got remarried, I was living only like 30 minutes away from the crash site. And then once we started the process, my wife was hired as the music director at the United States Military Academy. So then we got up and we moved to West Point. So now I was 7 hours away and I had to travel back to film. So the last 2 years have been constantly traveling between here and Hicksburg.
But as a kid growing up, did you hear stories about this? And I think, by the way, I saw that same episode of Unsolved Mysteries that you did, thanks to the power of streaming.
I didn't, because I lived just far enough away that it was the TV show that got everybody's attention. But, you know, then when I got to meet people from Mount Pleasant and that, and heard how, and Acme and Latrobe, PA, it was pretty amazing the amount of people that witnessed it that night or saw it, and the things I learned from there.
And those towns are all surrounding the Hicksburg area?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Latrobe's kind of neat. It's not very far away. Some of the addresses right by it are Latrobe addresses. And Latrobe is the town where Arnold Palmer and Mr. Rogers are from. Not a very big place, but it's produced a lot of really amazing people. About 5,000 people.
What were people reporting seeing?
An acorn. Some sort of acorn-shaped ship. That's why some people... actually, one of the people who helped us make the film, John Ventry, has said it was a Russian satellite. Of course, the government initially said it was a meteor. Then they said it was a Russian. First, they said nothing landed. Then they said it was a meteor. Then they said it was a Russian satellite. And the problem I have with that, because I worked in politics, is Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton, in 2016, when running for president against Donald Trump, filed a Freedom of Information request asking for the records on Hicksburg. And it's in WikiLeaks, also her and John Podesta discussing it. And she's told there's no records existing. So the question is, why did it matter at all to Hillary Clinton while running for president? That tells me it's not a Russian satellite. It's not that we broke the 63 treaty on satellite recovery, which was the excuse. And a standard thing to do is say there's no records, because that's the easy way not to have to present anything. So, and why could a former first lady and a former chief of staff for the president have not gotten access to these records?
Yeah, with the highest office, that is certainly a little concerning. By the way, this was a late afternoon, early evening sighting, December. So I can imagine it was probably either fully dark by then, or it was getting dark, and this bright acorn-looking thing, which is how it's described by everyone, lights up the sky, 7 states. I'm Jeremy Scott, talking with Cody Knotts, HicksburgMovie.com. We'll be right back.
Into the Paranormal is streaming 24/7 on the TuneIn Radio app and at ParanormalRadio.com.
I'm sorry to interrupt this broadcast. We have reports from Detroit of an object in the sky heading in a southeastern direction.
What on earth could there be that the military is not equipped to deal with?
Hicksburg.
Got two damned aliens roaming around in a populated area and multiple civilian witnesses.
Understood. Make preparations for the Gamora protocols.
What are the Gamora protocols?
Terminate all witnesses.
Our government will never do this. We have a constitution. Rights.
You have an illusion.
You can't stop the government.
It took a boy, Clutch. Doesn't that bother you?
They take our boys all the time.
I know. Let's blame it on the Russians.
The Russians.
That's right.
Perfect.
Stop them.
I want to speak to
Got Skype? Connect with us by searching ITP51 and click in. Or call toll-free 855-790-8255.
If you're picking up what Cody Knotts is laying down, sounds like we have the makings of a classic cover-up. Records lost. Those highest in power can't seem to get the info. And NASA actually has to be subpoenaed. A court order to produce the records. If it could be easily explainable that the records would be publicly available, correct?
Well, after 25 years, they're supposed to be, unless there's still some sort of national security. And again, what after the fall of the Soviet Union, if it's Russian or Soviet, it would have been, would be still a national security issue. The technology would be very old. We all know about keyhole now. So it seems a little odd to be hiding it.
But it's easier to just kind of, you know, blame a foreign power, because then it just takes, you know, all of the attention off the U.S. and says, well, you know, it was just a Soviet satellite, or it was this or it was that, because then people maybe don't look as closely as they maybe should.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that we tie into in the film is the whole idea of blaming on the Russians, which seems kind of funny in today's context. But the president actually then says it's perfect. The public always believes it's the Russians. And we believe that's part of what happened. Another thing that a lot of people, everybody talks about the object, and even people Stan has interviewed have said that it went to Wright-Patterson. We have no doubt that it ended up at some point at Wright-Patterson, but the idea that they drove it 7 hours, 8 hours over to Ohio is ludicrous. We live in a military installation. My wife works for the Department of Defense. They're going to get that undercover as quickly as possible. So the quickest place for them to have done that would have been to take it to Camp Dawson in West Virginia, which is 30 minutes away at a slow convoy. And we actually recreated that. And from there's an airfield. They could fly it to Wright-Patterson. They could fly it to Roswell. They could fly it anywhere they needed to. But it would be undercover in under 30 minutes. And so why would you risk 7 hours of a drive with something obviously in the back of a truck, which people saw, and why would not have literally thousands of people have seen it on the road traveling between there and Dayton? And Stan and I have actually argued about it. He said, I have witnesses. I said, you realize we give you witnesses. That's one of the things our government does. If I want to misdirect you, I'm going to have witnesses speak to people like Stan.
That's true.
And I'm going to be having to be very credible, and I'm going to misdirect them. So, and the reason we came to this conclusion wasn't that we were doing something so special. We talked to people who worked on Robert Byrd's staff, Senator Robert Byrd. And they told us, well, why wouldn't you get it to the Black Ops, which is done out of Camp Dawson? It's quicker and faster. And I was like, well, that makes a lot more sense than driving out of the back of the truck, which makes no sense whatsoever if I'm trying to keep something secret. Now, I might have had a truck go that way, so that people saw it as a diversion, so that even the people who are telling Stan this aren't lying, because it's even better if they see something and they repeat it, which means it might not even have went to Wright-Patterson. But we are fairly certain it went to Camp Dawson, which if you look up Camp Dawson and you learn more about what it is, and it's where we train the Tough Mountain, trains near there, and we train the Green Berets, there's a lot of reasons why we would take it there first. We test missiles underground there. The facility's 30 minutes. It was great to recreate the convoy. We put the Acorn on the back of a 6x6, a deuce and a half, and we drove it with a convoy of Jeeps from the time period all the way down there and filmed it for the film.
Cody, is it possible it could have been flown and not trucked?
No, they would have had to, because they have to get into an airfield. So they have to get into a military airfield and where they can control it. So the closest place for that to easily have done it without civilians seeing it would have been Camp Dawson and then fly it out. They've got to move it off that farm. Weight-wise, nobody saw a helicopter coming in and out. I don't even know. I'd have to go back and look to see if we had anything that could really have lifted it. Probably not. but that would have been seen and heard. These helicopters make a lot of noise. So it's a lot easier. And we have witnesses seeing it being pulled out of Kecksburg. So now it's where did it go and how fast did it get undercover? Again, the quickest, the closest locale and the easiest controlled with an airfield is Camp Dawson, which is right across the border in West Virginia. And here's another reason. The roads between it, which we went down, the quickest route, almost nobody saw us moving it that night. We probably had 6 or 7 cars max today, in today's time. So you could drive that road up and down those mountains, and nobody sees you doing it.
And if somebody does, then you just silence them before they're ever able to say something about it, as it seems to be happened in the Kecksburg incident.
Well, yeah, Mabel Mazza, who was John Murphy's secretary, who's still alive, we had her at the premiere, and she pointed out that they came, they told them that they had to hand over stuff. She told them they had a constitution. She was really excited because Ricky Nelson's granddaughter played a fictional character based on her. So Mabel was just thrilled that we did that, and we had Ricky's granddaughter, Remington Moses, walked her down the red carpet to walk in together. And Remy wore her grandmother's, because her great-grandmother's Ozzie and her great-grandparents were Ozzie and Harriet. So she had their Oscar gown, her great-grandmother's Oscar gown, which was really cool.
Well, and you assembled a top science team for the film as well, as you dig into this.
We wanted to make sure the science worked, and so the biggest person was Dr. Fuzzy Malden, who actually invented the search engine, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I use it every day.
We all use it. He makes jokes. We actually, he's on my Facebook and he converses with people. People have no idea what, and somebody one day, somebody said, you know, well, you think you're going to change the world? He said, I did that once. I don't need to do it again. And someone actually challenged him on something going with net neutrality and what the Google and them are doing. And they said, well, what would you do if you designed the internet? And it was really funny because he didn't say I did, or the search engines. He just answered the question. Well, this is the things I would do looking at it now. And the guy just kept hammering him. And I actually wrote the guy because we were laughing and not saying anything, responding. I wrote the guy privately because he's a friend and said, by the way, you're asking the man who invented the search engine, what would he do if he invented the search engine? you're dealing. It was really silly because people don't, they're always shocked. Like, why is he just sitting on Facebook? Well, because he's retired. He's been retired, as he says, for a really long time, and he has no interest in ever having to work again. He volunteered his time, and that was really cool. He wrote the alien language, which we based on language from an Inuit language that has only 12 speakers left. So we used that as the basis. And the aliens speak one time in the film, and then the writing is based off of their language.
We're talking Kecksburg tonight with Cody Knotts. I'm Jeremy Scott from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest. Brad Bernards has paranormal news right after this.
Save your data and listen for free by calling 701-719-9703, courtesy of TalkStream Live. Parabnormal News, I'm Brad Bernards. NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite has discovered its first Earth-sized planet in its star's habitable zone, the range of distances where conditions may be just right to allow the presence of liquid water on the surface.
Scientists wanted independent confirmation of TOI 700D, so they monitored its star with NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope. Spitzer saw a clear transit from the outer planet, affirming its existence and improving scientists' certainty of the planet's size.
TOI 700 is a small, cool M-dwarf star located just 100 light-years away in the southern constellation Dorado. It's roughly 40% of the sun's mass and size and about half its surface temperature.
According to Space.com, the jets emanating from a famous black hole are cruising along at about 99% the speed of light, according to new observations. Researchers spotted the speedy jets emanating from a black hole in the galaxy M87, the same black hole that was imaged directly for the first time last year. NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory imaged knots of material speeding away from the accretion disk, where gas, dust, and other material swirl around the black hole. Read the news at ParabnormalRadio.com. I'm Brad Bernards, Parabnormal News.
Weird again. One show at a time. You're traveling into the paranormal. Jeremy Scott.
Well, there's plenty to make America weird. And we talk about the weird and the strange and the paranormal, the parabnormal, every week here on this program. Cody Knotts is my guest tonight. KexburgMovie.com or KexburgUFOMovie.com. It will get you to the same place. You know, we were talking right before the break there about the scientific team that he has assembled. So you start with the man who invented the search engine, which is a big coup. And then who else?
Dr. Nathan Morehouse from, he was at the University of Pitt, who is an evolutionary biologist, because we wanted the alien figures. We had people's accounts, but we wanted to get into what they might look like. And we ended up with a little bit of a potbelly. Because if they're traveling a long time, they're probably going to be storing fat. And we also decided that they probably have a dual digestive system so that they can consume both photogenically water and soil and also proteins, which was an interesting thing. So they were definitely omnivores, but we made them have this photosynthesis thing, which I thought was kind of fun. You don't see it much in the film. It only comes up. There's an autopsy scene with Maria Olson that was in Percy Jackson. She makes a cameo. She's in two scenes in the film, but she's doing an autopsy. And we had a little bit of fun with that. The only downside was that we couldn't film it. The two actors weren't in the space. So we had a stand-in to help make it look like he was there because our one actor is in his active duty military. So he wasn't available at the time we filmed her again.
So we've pretty much well established that there was some sort of a cover-up going on, and you mentioned that the men in black were involved as well, likely harassing witnesses and telling them to keep their mouths shut. Why do you believe the government is, we can say lying, certainly they're not telling the truth, and they're trying to misdirect. Why are they doing this with the Kexburg incident?
I believe even more than Roswell, again, because of the Hillary Clinton connection, that this is a clear sign of potential alien life, which now we're having things that our Navy is chasing. That joke they did on Comedy Central, if Trump's elected president, all of a sudden we're going to find out aliens are real. Well, all of a sudden we're finding out that there's something from outer space coming to this planet. Why is there a renewed interest in being on the moon? Why is all this happening at once?
Why do we have a space force?
Why do we have a space force? Which was a lot of competition. I mean, here at West Point, they, you know, everybody wanted to be in charge of the new space force. The Air Force won. I mean, it'll be a separate branch, but it'll be 130,000 people are being transferred to space force. That's a significant investment. Eventually, I think the first 15,000 or something is being transferred over. But I mean, that's something truly different. And we have just this last year, we started a space warfare major that you can have at the U.S. military academy. So why are we doing this? You know, it's not like it could be the Chinese, but more likely it's because we suspect something we're going to have to deal with in outer space. And we're even changing protocols on how we engage with satellites and things in outer space. And so, I mean, the public is caught up in the smoke and mirrors and all the crazy on the news. And these things are happening for people that are paying attention. So I believe Kexburg is much bigger than anybody realizes.
Could it be that the U.S. is actually covering up for a foreign power like Russia or China?
No, I don't think so. I think that this is more aliens. I mean, I there'd be no reason for them to
say it wasn't supposed to crash and say it was from the Russians and say it did actually crash here. And they're part right. Yes, it's from the Soviets, but it's not a satellite. It was actually a UFO, but it just, you know, it had a mishap. I'm just wondering if you think that that's a possibility.
Technology that we didn't have, we would have seen it by now. I mean, if you think about it, one of the things people don't do with the timelines is 1965 is 55 years from now, right? So it's the equivalent technology of 1910. And so one of the things that we're not to 1965. So if a biplane crashed in an area, we might cover it up then, but we're not going to cover it up 55 years later, especially if a first lady or whatever is looking at it. That wouldn't make any sense. And this technology is that much older. And we forget that because it happens within our lifetime. I'm really in the timelines. When I used to do investigative reporting, I would break everything down in a timeline. And it gives a whole new perspective. And many of these mistakes are made. I mean, they're made in mainstream TV shows. They're made in Mad Men. He meets with World War II veterans, and they look like they're 80 years old. It's supposed to be 1969. Well, those guys are in their 40s. A World War II veteran is in his 40s. And so it's completely wrong, but it's the way we perceive them. So we perceive things further apart than they are. In this case, we think the 60s are closer to us now. I mean, I was born in 68, so it doesn't seem that far back to my lifetime. So they're just trying to show perspective. I don't think it has anything to do with anything domestic at all or terrestrial.
Interesting. So I want to go back to something you said. You said the alien language. Was this something that folks had reported seeing in the original incident, or is this something that you added in?
Yes. No, there was some sort of writing on the object. A lot of people think it was Cyrillic because of the Russian idea, because of the nature of it. But the eyewitnesses referred to it as more like hieroglyphics. So they're assuming these people didn't have any idea what Cyrillic looked like.
Written on the acorn shaped object?
Yes, on the circular part of the acorn.
That's right.
So we decided we had to know what that language said and what it says on the ship. And so you see it in the film briefly, but most of that's in the book. So we have the entire, our interpretation of the language in the book with a whole breakdown of it. Like, so you can actually go, if I want to say this, this is how I would say it, with some example words. And Dr. Malden did all of that. He created an entire language and used numbers as the basis. And in fact, one of the things he did at first, we thought it was too logical, too number-based, because language is emotional. So we had him redo it with a little more emotional, the fact that organic creatures are more emotion than logic. I always say that we're, as human beings, and I think this is of any animal, any mammal, at least, and that's what I think we can go from, that we are emotional before we're logical. And so just still a child and watch how many times he has a tantrum and has to learn to control his emotions. So we wanted to have that in there. So between Dr. Malden and my wife, and my wife speaks like five different languages, so she's kind of cool on that. They worked that out and we came to a conclusion on what we wanted the language to be.
Was anybody able to decode what this language was trying to communicate?
Not that we know of. I mean, if they did, they've never told the public.
Yeah.
So that's why we had to just start and go, okay, what are we going to do? And then we had to have it painted. We had to have stencils and put onto the spaceship. Unfortunately, we didn't raise all the money we wanted. We wanted to make... Dr. Malden designed the entire ship, including the interior and what the interior would look like. And was it based upon the publications, how big of creatures could have been inside? That's why we came to the 4.5 feet tall, which fit with the eyewitness descriptions. But it had fit to 4.5 feet tall creatures with space for movement and survival over a period. And we believe it was a lander, a smaller craft connected to a larger craft. But with that, we even had space for the collection of rocks or geological. So he worked all that out and then the propulsion system, and we just couldn't raise the money to turn it, to make it the way we wanted as a set and then have it as an exhibit. That was the plan. And donate it to the town. Just, it just didn't happen. We had a solid structure for a ship, and it was half the size that was supposed to be for the film.
Well, sometimes that's how it goes in the crowdfunding business. I know what you mean by that. From the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, I'm Jeremy Scott. It's Kexburg tonight with my guest, Cody Knotts. We'll be right back.
Make sure to subscribe to Into the Paranormal's free YouTube channel for shows, news, and exclusive reports. From a remote location, nearly as top secret as Area 51. Yeah, and if you believe that, you'll really like this show. Into the Paranormal.
An acorn object lighting up the sky and crashing late afternoon, early evening, December 9th, 1965 in Kexburg, Pennsylvania. You no doubt have heard about the Kexburg incident. If you have read any books on the UFO subject, if you've seen any documentaries, watched any of those so-called reality TV shows, NASA did release about 40 pages in November of 2003 after being subpoenaed. They were subpoenaed by the Sci-Fi Channel and by investigative reporter Leslie Keene. NASA says something did fall. Something was recovered, but that it was a Russian satellite. And then a couple of years later, just before the 40th anniversary in 2005, NASA said that they had examined metallic fragments and said that it was the Russian satellite that re-entered the atmosphere and then broke up. At that point, Keene filed an additional request for information. Another lawsuit, in fact, forced NASA to basically hand over these documents. She got them 2 years later. However, they were missing, several pages were, or destroyed, or had nothing to do with the case. So the bait and switch continues. Cody Knotts, the filmmaker of Kexburg Movie, was telling us about the crowdfunding stage, making the film, and the alien language. And you mentioned that the beings themselves were about 4 feet tall. What other physical characteristics were reported, and how were they portrayed in your film?
That they had 3 fingers, that some of the witnesses that Stan had interviewed that said that they had 3 fingers or claws. So we incorporated the design of the interior of the ship, which did not appear in the film because of a lack of funding, but it's in the book, is all based on hexagons. Because of the 3 fingers. And so Michael created this whole thing revolving around 3 fingers and how what they would have to manipulate, including the joystick. Basically, the stick they're using to steer, and he built everything on that. So it was really cool. I wish we could have pulled it off, but it's neat that we have it in the book with a lot of details about the alien structure. I mean, you see the aliens only briefly in the film because we didn't want to show them too much, because it was really about our government and our government lying to its citizens. That was the main focus of the story. That somewhere post-World War II, by 1965, in 20 years, we've become a country in that 20-year period that doesn't tell the truth to its own citizens, even to the point of potentially killing them.
Tell us how John Murphy got involved in this case.
Well, John gets called to the scene by a lady in the town. And like, why does a woman call a radio station instead of saying we had to create a reason? There's a historic person who made the call, but we made it the fire chief's wife so we could connect the story better. But he goes out there. He sees something that changes the course of his life. He apparently doesn't let go of it. And according to Mabel Madison, now Stan disagrees, but Mabel believes the government killed him. He was killed by a hit and run, unsolved, and years later. And so was Mr. Betters, and he has a brother that's famous, and I always get him back. Harold Betters is the famous one. Gary Betters is the one that dies, I believe. I got him right. His brother's a famous trombonist. And Gary wouldn't let go of it either, and he also died from an unsolved hit and run. that I find kind of fascinating. But John's the main crux of our story, and Scott Cooper from South Africa plays him. And it was a lot of fun to work with him and see him bring John Murphy to life. He talked to Mabel, so he got an idea of what John Murphy was. She made a joke that Scott's a very good-looking man. She said, John was not a good-looking man. So that was pretty funny that we had this really attractive John Hamm-looking like actor as John Murphy.
And the Men in Black make an appearance, don't they, as well?
Yes, and there's lots of Men in Black, but the main one is played by this Agent Kirk Donovan, which we made a bastard son of Wild Bill Donovan, who was in charge of the OSS during World War II. And he's played by Eric Hack, who's actually deployed right now in Baghdad in the siege of the embassy. He was there. We were a little concerned because our protagonist was over there fighting for his country. But he did a great job, and the Men in Black are a major part of the film, and they're present everywhere.
Can you tell us about some of the other cast members that are in the film as well?
Yeah, we have Sonia Orsalon, who is the leading actress out of Hungary. She's playing a Hungarian-American, and she lives in the United States now. So that was quite a find. We have Ricky Nelson's granddaughter, which I mentioned, playing the woman at the radio station who works with Murphy. Scott Joshua and Scott Levy. We had three Scots, which got kind of crazy. I had to go by their last name. Scott Joshua plays a character based on the African-American musicians who went out to the scene. And Scott Levy plays the fire chief, which we named Stan after Stan Gordon to honor Stan and all his efforts of Kecksburg, and is at the scene and held by the government. And my wife plays Lady Bird Johnson briefly. Caesar James, who's a character actor out of L.A., plays Robert Byrd. And I make a brief appearance as a racist soldier, which is a lot of fun. And in fact, it's probably one of the coolest scenes, because if you want to know what it was like to be black and stopped in a car in 1965, that scene will bring back the memories, the bad ones, I guess. I always play a bad guy. But no one could perform the scene the way we wanted, so the producer said, why don't you do it? And I said, fine, him in the uniform. And I got out from behind the camera.
How can we see the film?
We are going to be doing a release in theaters in March or April. I'm actually meeting in L.A. in January to finalize details. And then we're going to, after that, we will be selling Blu-rays and DVDs online. Follow us on our website, or even better, on Facebook, because we updated even more there. Then it'll go on streaming after that. We'll go pay streaming on all the sites, and then we'll switch over to Prime and that much later. So come spring, April is the target date right now.
What is your current thoughts on the day of UFO disclosure or non-disclosure that we're living in?
Well, I think we're starting to get to the truth, but I think that the upheaval to society, if there is aliens and other life, would be terrifying. You have to start looking. I think one of the people made a good analogy to the Incas and what they encountered, or the Aztecs, when they first, the Incas are probably even better, when they first encountered the white man. The Aztecs had a history of the idea of a white savior that let them react differently. We wouldn't have that, but what would it do to us? What would it cause us with our religions, with our way of viewing ourselves in the world? And we're very Earth-centric, obviously. And how would we respond? You know, I think a lot of people would find it funny. I mean, the most powerful nation in the world is the United States. Well, these United States or China, most likely the United States, going to lead the world in defense. And does that mean Donald Trump is leading the world into a defense against an alien power? And so, you know, our people amongst us, we play on that. We have other aliens on the planet in the film, without giving away too much, and that there's aliens amongst us, which is kind of fun. I mean, I directed a film with Roddy Piper, and of course he made the film They Live, with John Carpenter. I like bringing any element in that ties back into Roddy, because it was really special getting to direct him in one of his last films. I was a big fan of his growing up.
KecksburgUFOMovie.com. Thank you so much for coming on the program tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's the Kecksburg UFO incident, December 9th, 1965. KecksburgMovie.com. I am Jeremy Scott. If you haven't been to the Paranormal Store, We encourage you to stop by. Just go to paranormalradio.com, click the store button. We're going to talk about disclosure efforts coming up with Stephen Bassett from the Paradigm Research Group and kind of look at what's going on. I'll talk to you then.